Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here on this beautiful, warm morning in Sedona. Sitting across from me, our beloved senior special
third wheel,
Gary LeMaster.
Good morning.
Mike Cosentino has returned to his roots in Buffalo, New York. I guess we'll see him again next week.
He's loading up on wings and pizza and views of the Niagara Falls. I guess.
Right, and how he had pictures of Anchor Bar, which is where Buffalo Wings were created. And last time I had them, which was many years ago, they had the best wings around. Anyway, Mike, bring us those wings, and we'll get serious here and talk about the new Iran nuclear agreement. I think if you're looking at this objectively, in a lot of ways, this is the greatest triumph of the Obama administration in foreign affairs. It is a triumph for negotiation over war. We tend to look at it, and Gary and I will talk about it, we tend to look at this as a deal between the United States and Iran, but it's not really that, is it, Gary?
It's a deal between the U.S., Iran, and the world.
Exactly. It's what do they call them? The P5 plus one and Iran. So it's a deal with that Iran is in the process of signing a deal, not only with the United States, but with Germany, England, France, Russia, and China, who all now have a stake in this agreement. It's not just the U.S., which they have a lot of complaints about because of our history with them, but it's with all the major nations with nuclear powers, with the exception of India, Pakistan, and Israel, and
North Korea.
And North Korea. That's right. I forget North Korea. Let's talk about Iran as a country, because we think we should go back a little bit, folks, so you understand what Iran is, a little about our history with it, but also go ahead, Gary, you can.
Well, I was going to say, when you talk about the people that negotiated this deal, the hyperbole with the right wing in the U.S. would have you believe that it was simply a bad deal that was negotiated by that weak-kneed liberal Obama and John Kerry.
They were really insulting to the Secretary of State and to the Secretary of Energy when they tried to testify. It wasn't an argument. It was just a series of insults.
And I'd like to remind people that the deal included such weak-kneed liberals as Putin's Russia, Merkel's Germany, France, Britain, and China, along with the U.S. and Iran. So this was a deal that included, some serious players on the world stage.
It's been endorsed by the Security Council. Violating this rule is very different. See, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is the whole basis in the past of inspections of Iran, was not signed by this Iranian government. It was signed by the Shah's government that they overthrew. They never renounced that treaty, but it's never been their own. Now, the Iranian government is going to own this big time in front of the whole world. If they violate it, this is something no one's talking about. If they violate it, besides all the technical stuff we're going to go through about how hard it's going to be to do that, if they violate it, they're really not going to have a friend in the world. They're not going to have anyone who will be able to defend them from really draconian sanctions. And we'll talk about the snapback and all these other mechanisms built into the plan. But from the point of view of Iran, if they violate this agreement, they made an enemy and a fool of everybody else, and they're going to be in a really very difficult situation without friends.
They'll be one of the pariahs of the world. They'll live up to Bush's
rhetoric about
that they were part of the so-called axis of evil.
Right, and it'll put them. Now that may not sound like anything, but sanctions do work. They worked in South Africa, and they worked in Iran because everybody jumps on them. If just the United States sanctions, it's not a huge deal. Depends on the relationship of U.S. with the country in terms of import, exports, and all the rest of that stuff. But if you have the whole world pissed off at you, and if you publicly lied, all right. The other thing I want to talk about is something that no one talks about, and that's if you look at the scenarios of what happened, and then we'll go to the details of the thing. The scenario of what happened is something like this. Iran secretly decides that they're going to make nuclear material. Gary will explain to you how difficult this is and what's involved and what are the different routes to having a bomb. Let's suppose they get caught. Well, they're in a lot of trouble with everyone. The treaty will go by the by. The sanctions will snap back. There'll be even worse sanctions against them. And they'll be visibly renounced the treaty that they signed on.
The sanctions, by the way, will snap back within 65 days.
Yeah.
So it's a short time period.
So, and suppose they get caught and they say, oh, okay, we won't make a bomb. All right, that's one scenario. They'll look really, really bad. There'll be sanctions will snap back, and they will have a problem undoing it. Suppose they make a bomb, and nobody catches them. Now, we're supposed to believe that this is basically the end of the world. But Israel has 400 bombs, a survivable nuclear capacity. The United States has thousands of bombs. So does China and Russia. One bomb gets them nothing. It goes nowhere. If they use it, Iran is destroyed. There's nothing to do with it. Some people have to come up with these obscure scenarios. They will give it to some terrorist group, and they will blow up a bomb in Israel. But the chances of that are almost zero. This is an oppressive regime in Iran. But it's time, folks, to be realistic about it. It's survived since 1979. It's a calculating, brutal regime. It's a bureaucracy.
And it's moderating.
Yeah, and it's moderating. And it's not filled with absolute crazies. And when the Iranian people have been given a choice on voting it, twice they've elected moderate religious figures to run the country. Now, a single bomb doesn't get them anywhere. All the sanctions then come collapsing back in on them. Everything happens. The United States goes right back to "we will attack you." Israel goes right back to "we will attack." They'll have gained nothing. They'll have had to sneak around for decades, and they will gain absolutely nothing from it. It's a very unattractive prospect. It's not about are they good guys or bad guys. The price they would pay for one bomb, which they really couldn't use, is extraordinary. And so if you begin to parse out the different scenarios of what would happen if they violate the agreement, it's not going anywhere. Right, Gary? I mean, it is. Got anything to add here, Gary?
No, I think it'd be useful. You know, you had mentioned the history of Iran. I think it'd be useful to look at how we got to where we are.
Yeah,
and to talk a little bit about Iran. It's the largest population in the Middle East.
It's approaching 80 million people.
It's larger than all of the other Gulf states combined.
It's about the size of Alaska. It's about twice as big as Texas. It has some of the tallest mountain ranges east of the Himalayas. It has the tallest mountain. It's a series of it. It has deep forest in the northern part of it. lots of desert. It's extremely complex geography.
It's a historic, the remnants of a historic empire, the Persian Empire. It's a very sophisticated culture, you know, much more so than its Arab neighbors. It actually spends less money per capita on weapons than all of its neighbors in the region, which I found somewhat surprising. And, you know, it's been under sanctions for a long time. And I'd like to remind people that, the GOP was absolutely opposed to sanctions before they're for them.
I remember John Bolton's speech that sanctions won't work, they'll right. never work, right. it is giving Iran. And now, this is the, John Bolton is the crazy guy with the walrus mustache.
He was the U.N. ambassador under the Bush administration.
And one of the most extreme people in the American
still
government.
Still is, yes. And so they were against the sanctions before. Now they're absolutely, we must keep the sanctions on because the sanctions are working. But originally they said the sanctions would never work. As a result of the sanctions, unemployment in Iran has skyrocketed. It's now at least a minimum of 24%. And it hasn't squeezed the government. It has squeezed the Iranian people.
So what happened is, if you look back at the U.S.-Iran relationship, it's been extremely troubled. The United States and Britain overthrew a duly elected government of Iran with a secret operation. They installed the Shah. The Shah was supposed to be a constitutional monarch, but he declared himself to be an absolute looter.
Looter,
yes,
is a good term.
Absolute ruler after that. This led to incredible bitterness. It took a long time for proof of what they had done to come out.
And the reason, I think we should talk about the reason that they that we helped overthrow their government was because their elected government had the audacity to nationalize its oil fields. Which would take them away from U.S. and British companies.
So the Shah acts very independent. He's sort of like Karzai. He's unstable. He goes through the motions. But to Iranian people, he looks pretty much like a lackey of the United States. When the economy begins to crumble for various complex reasons in the late 70s, his popularity, never great, he's not really the Shah in the sense of some hereditary ruler. He has no legitimacy beyond what public relations can establish. When that happens, forces build up to overthrow him. And in 1979, I think, Gary, the Islamic Revolution overthrows the Shah. It's a long, complicated dance of different forces from moderates to extremists. The bad blood from the United States points of view, because from the United States point of view, we haven't really done anything, and there's no acknowledgement of what we've done and why the Iranians are angry. The United States is advised by all of the State Department not to let the Shah enter the United States.
The Shah had had some
cancer,
medical issue, and wanted to come to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
Okay, so the Shah wants to come. The U.S. lets him in. A student group, an Islamic student group, seizes the American embassy. According to the leader of it, they planned to do it as a symbolic protest. They were going to go in, release people, and it was going to make a point. The U.S. embassy in Iran, until shortly before it was taken over, had 1,000 people, a huge campus with 1,000 people. So you have, you know, frankly, in the Middle East, there's a lot of paranoid and conspiracy theories. You can imagine what this giant place with 1,000 employees doing stuff looked like to the Iranian and why they took it over. And they have some crazy name for what they did. It's called the removal of the spy haven of the United States or something like this. So
probably was true.
Probably is true. But the but that starts the bad blood. It causes Jimmy Carter probably to lose the election because he can't resolve it diplomatically, and the military means collapse. The operation fails, not his fault, but the operation failed. It helps to bring in Ronald Reagan to power. It leaves a legacy of bad feelings, because the one thing, if they had taken over the embassy and released people, I don't think the American people would care. But for, I think, 444 days, something like that, they held Americans hostages. And it brewed incredible frustration and anger in the United States. And relationships have been absolutely terrible ever since.
Right. If you jump forward to the Bush administration after 9/11, you know, we have to look at why Iran has a nuclear ambition. And, you know, they had never attempted to create a nuclear program. And by the way, you have to look at this as not one facility. It's an entire
nuclear weapons program. Shah started the nuclear program. Shah was building nuclear energy in Iran.
But they had no apparent interest in building bombs until they were labeled by the Bush administration as one of the members, along with Iraq and North Korea, as the axis of evil. And when we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, Iran found itself sandwiched between American and coalition forces in Afghanistan and American and coalition forces in Iraq. And they realized that the North Koreans had a nuclear weapon and they weren't attacked. They were one of the members of the Axis of Evil that wasn't threatened or attacked. So I think it makes sense that that's when they decided to start their nuclear program.
The thing is that the founder of the Islamic Republic, Khomeini, said that nuclear weapons were anti-Islam, that they could not build a nuclear weapon. Understand that Iran has had – the question really, if you step back a bit, is why Iran doesn't have the bomb if India and Pakistan have it. I mean, why don't they? Because they could certainly do it. They've got the population. They've got the scientists and so forth and so on. Why didn't they? Well, it was forbidden. So – we don't know exactly what happened. It's never been certain. But the information, and we'll talk more about this, the information that they were trying to build the bomb is based on them refining uranium beyond the amount, the percentage that they needed, right, Gary, in order to build a nuclear reactor or even isotopes.
They acquired a lot more centrifuges than they needed and refined uranium to beyond a domestic energy level to a weapons grade uranium.
Well, they I don't know if they ever got it there. Weapons grade uranium is 90%. And
right,
I think they were in the 40%. But going from 40 to 90 is not. So they were refining this stuff. Nobody really knows exactly what they intended. They certainly never intended, they never set up actually assembled a bomb. It looks to most people who analyze this like they were setting up, what's it called, the Japan solution, which you have all the elements of an atomic bomb, but you don't put them together. So you can say you don't have an atomic bomb. But if somebody attacks you, you can put the one together pretty quickly. So that was the fear. That was the fear. The Iran had signed the non-proliferation treaty, as we mentioned. India, Pakistan, Israel never signed it. They have lots and lots of nuclear weapons. And that was the basis of all these inspections. The basis of inspection is a treaty that Iran signed. And Iran was one of the first countries in the world in the first decade after the non-proliferation treaty was getting going. It was one of the first countries in the world to sign on to this. It puts them in a difficult spot. So there's the IAEA are the inspectors. Now, they were never intended to be a draconian super spy agency to track countries. It was, they were supposed to inspect that everybody who signed the non-proliferation treaty was obeying the rules, right?
Right.
So it took them a while to get up to speed to find out what Iran was doing. But basically, Iran got caught, even with a less experienced group of people and even with less efficient spying made. So what were they doing? Well, I'm on the group that think they were, I'm not even sure they were planning to build a bomb to assemble equipment, but what they were doing was building up all the different parts of it so that they could put them together if they got permission, basically from the religious powers to do so.
Let's talk about what the deal is.
You okay.
Know, it's because I think it's, when I went to research this, I found it difficult to find actual information about it that, wasn't, colored by either side, that, especially if you just Google the deal, what you find is a whole lot of conservative sites that give you a very one-sided view of the deal.
There's another problem, isn't there, Gary, that like we tend to read fairly extensively in reports and stuff. This deal is the treaty is almost unreadable. You really need experts of one kind or another to tell you what the different things mean. It is just too dense and too technical for us to penetrate on our own and figure out exactly what's going on. So we are dependent on honest brokers about the treaty. The treaty also has secret sessions about what Iran has agreed to do in terms of inspection. So there's the public section, which is 90% of it, and then there are some appendixes that are basically secret.
What I took most of this information from is from a whole lot of different sources. There was a great show a week ago Sunday with Fareed Zakaria's GPS, Global Public Square, on CNN, had some of the people involved in the negotiations. Anyway, as near as I can tell, after 22 months of negotiations with seven participants, including the U.S. and Iran, Iran has agreed to cut its centrifuges by two-thirds, limit research and new facilities for 10 years, cut its uranium gas stockpile by 97%, agrees to no new enrichment above 4%, and no new facilities for 15 years, to cut plutonium production in its new reactor by 90%.
Let's pause a second, Gary. The way that you do the verification is based on the two routes to having a nuclear bomb. One is the uranium route, which is when you hear all this talk about centrifuges, uranium, when it comes out of the ground, has a very low amount of U-235, which is the radioactive isotope that's used in all nuclear reactors and bombs and everything else. The centrifuges that you hear so much about are a way of separating, because there's a different molecular weight between U-235 and U-230, of separating it out. So that's when they're talking about they're separating out the stuff that you can use from the stuff that you can't use.
Right. Refining.
Yeah, refining. It's a refining process. And so the debate is over refining process. The other way you can do it is through plutonium. And they were building a plutonium-based reactor in Iraq, Iraq, I think it's called. And that's the other route. And what the deal does is block the two routes. In other words, you're not looking at the last-minute assembling of things. You're looking at the materials that they can use to make a bomb, and you're tracing and blocking that usage.
From the mine forward.
Right. And so for the deal for the mines is we get to inspect their uranium mines. They have two uranium mines. We get to inspect the milling process. We get to measure everything. But the plutonium reactor, they've agreed to – basically turn it into something that cannot produce weapons-grade plutonium, and to export anything that they have. So the two routes are plutonium and uranium, and the treaty blocks both, and I think it's more absolute with plutonium than it is with the uranium. But in other words, there are inspections at all different levels and all different places that prevent them from refining the uranium to weapons grade. And even if they do, you know, they'll have like one bomb, maybe two bombs. It's not going anywhere. And I think from the Iranian point of view, why go through all this suffering when you have a bomb you can't use? It's not even going to protect you.
So just to finish on the rest of the agreement, it calls for no new reactors of any kind in Iran for 15 years. Permanent monitoring of all centrifuge manufacturing for 20 years.
That's trying to interdict the producing of high-grade uranium isotope.
Confine all purchases to monitored procurement channel for 25 years.
That means they can't go buy the stuff to make a bomb from anybody. You're monitoring where all their imports of technology and materials.
Monitoring of all uranium mines for 25 years. A permanent ban on any nuclear weapons research or activities. A permanent ban on reprocessing of fuel to extract plutonium. A permanent agreement to permanent intrusive inspections. And I want to clarify something that the Republicans have created some confusion on. You know, there's a lot of hyperbole on the right, but you may have heard that they talk about how they have to give Iran notice that of 24 to 48 hours before they can inspect sites. That's absolutely false. The inspection of the known sites is ongoing and can be by surprise. It's at any time. The 24 to 48 hour rule applies to any sites that we may discover after the signing of the agreement. So, in other words, it doesn't allow inspectors to just go willy-nilly throughout the country, unannounced.
And there's certain sites that they have to give a 14-day notice. You can't really clean up, I don't think, in today's a nuclear site in 14 days. And so where the 24-day figure comes from is that if the United States and the other countries that are part of the agreement decide there's a problem, and understand the United States has a majority on this board, I mean, conceivably, who would vote against it? Russia, China, and Iran. They can inspect the thing. So it'll be 14 days, and then it'll be another about 10 days or a week before they can send inspectors in. Most experts think that's plenty of time. Obviously, you'd want to have 24-hour, but all these things are compromises. And when you talk about negotiations, you get compromises. When you talk about wars, look what the war in Iraq and Afghanistan have gotten us. Have they gotten us more than negotiations? I don't think so.
I had said 24 hours. You're right, it's 24 days. I think the line I saw that says it best is from a Slate magazine writer, Joe Cirincione, if I can pronounce that, says the beauty of this agreement is that Iran gets to keep its buildings and we get to take out all of the furniture.
Pretty much it. And snapback. You're going to hear about snapback. Now, the thing is, the United States is insecure to other countries because they want to trade with Iran. Iran is a moderately big country. It has oil, and China and Russia and Germany and France want to trade with them. They want to get back to the kind of trade that is normal in thing. So the United States felt that maybe they would be reluctant to slap back sanctions on Iran, particularly if it's ambiguous what they're doing. It's not a really strong proof that they're violating. It's a little iffy. So there's what they call the snapback provision.
Right.
What's that, Gary?
Which reinstates the sanctions within 65 days. The one thing that we should go over what the U.S. and the five powers agreed to. The one thing that couldn't be immediately restored to its previous state is the fact that when the Islamic Revolution took place, the U.S. froze Iranian assets that were in the U.S., bank accounts in U.S. banks. And so what the agreement calls for is unfreezing approximately $100 billion in Iranian assets. And I couldn't find out if that's a staged release or if that's all at once. So there's the fear that they're going to take that money and use it to give to terrorists. You know?
Right. Now, it's interesting that first the Iran is portrayed as being an overriding nuclear threat. And this is by countries who have hundreds of nuclear bombs, or a country who doesn't have one. Right. It's an overwhelming threat. Now, there's all kinds of argument. One I thought was really interesting, Gary, is the one you heard, which is like, well, that'll give them a lot more money, and then they'll be able to begin to build up their conventional arms. And they'll have more money. What they'll do with it is another question. They're under a lot of pressure from the Iranian people to develop a successful economy. The United States, as long as the United States can be blamed for all their problems, it strengthens the powers that be in Iran. When you have a deal that releases the money, Iran wants released of the money not to go help the Palestinians or Hezbollah, but to get relief for its people who are getting tired of all the sanctions. So that's one issue. The other one I thought was really, maybe in the Wall Street Journal or something, some similar one, was, oh my gosh, if we sign this deal, then Iran will start producing oil and the price of oil will drop. And I suppose the price you pay for gasoline will drop. And to oil companies, this was very terrible thing happening that will really be a damaging to the U.S., a drop in oil prices because there's more supply.
Because we fracked our way to new independence. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, the reasons will change depending on the deal. The other argument, the Republicans in the House had an op-ed in the Arizona Republic, and it has this similar argument.
But before they read the deal, by the way.
Before they read the deal, it's clear that they hadn't read the deal. They hadn't even been briefed before they took this position. First of it bashes the international inspectors. It acts like the international inspector teams are like they were 25 years ago and not like they are today.
And by the way, these inspection teams proved to be right in Iraq.
Yes. You know,
they were demeaned by Republicans going into the Iraq war. They were, you know, we were told that they were ineffective. And after the invasion of Iraq and we found no weapons of mass destruction, it was shown to be, you know, that the inspectors had been right all along.
There were no weapons of mass destruction. The other thing that I think is one of the interesting things the Republicans are saying, well, it doesn't solve everything. It doesn't solve all the problems between Iraq and the United States. It doesn't, Iraq supports Hezbollah, which is the Shiite militia in Lebanon. It has the support of the people there. It's uncomfortable, but that's the truth. And it will allow them to do all kinds of things. It doesn't solve all the problems. Well, you can't solve all the problems between the United States and Iran with one deal. Let's take one step, and then we can see if we can work on things like dropping the rhetoric and dropping the support for retaliation against attacks on them.
The Iranian rhetoric, by the way, has already moderated some.
Yeah.
And the thing that is not talked about is that the relaxation of the sanctions is done slowly over a period of time, and it can be snapped back, as we mentioned, within 65 days.
And that's what I think when we did the show in April about the preliminary agreement. The consensus is that the preliminary agreement was far better than anyone thought it was going to be. All the objective people looking at it. This agreement goes beyond the preliminary agreement and getting even more of the U.S. position in there.
And I like to you know, compare it to, as others have done, to Nixon's and Kissinger's overtures to China. You know, this deal is very similar, different circumstances, but very similar to the opening of China. At the time, in 1971, when they opened the door to China, China was a sponsor of terrorism. Iran is a sponsor of terrorism now.
Terrorism being in the eye of beholder, of course,
right.
But yes.
And 71, China was financing the North Vietnam's war against the U.S. And today, Iran is financing, we're told, the actions against Israel. You know, Hezbollah and Hamas. So it's not that different. You know, what was the result of the China deal? They're now our largest trading partner.
It's an evolutionary process. And so you get one deal in and it works. Then you can talk about other deals and other sanctions being listed. Remember, this deal releases and undoes the sanctions that are based on Iran's nuclear program. The sanctions based on its support for terrorism, and if you read, I was reading some of the U.S. reports on terrorism, and the truth is they're extraordinarily biased, as they always were. They're politically confined by things, and they're kind of unconvincing, a lot of good information, but they're basically biased. But the thing to remember is that this is a major first step. The other thing we haven't talked about, Gary, is one of the reasons that I'm optimistic about where this is going is that the vast majority, or I would say the majority of Iran's population right now is under 35 years old.
Right.
The demographics are against the regime. So what we're trying to do is prevent a war, prevent an aggravation. Israel wanted the United States to attack Iran and make enemies for forever. But I think what we do is we draw this out, and there have been movements. And when I studied the Green Revolution a few years ago, my gosh, the authorities in Iran had control of all the levers of power, and they were able to suppress it. But you saw young people come out in massive things. It's not a nice government, but it has a demographic problem. And the problem is that the young people are restless. They don't really like the regime. They want an opening to the West. They want prosperity. They want to be able to travel, and they want to do all the things that younger people want to do.
Exactly.
And so I think that's a lot of the internal motivation. So when we talked about what happens to Iran if they violate the agreement and they get caught in the international community, okay, the Iranian government, maybe the hardiest of the hardliners take over and they say, we're going to just trash this agreement. And then the sanctions.
Are you talking about Iran or the U.S.?
In Iran. The sanctions kick back in. Okay.
There are hardliners on both sides.
Right. But I'm talking about suppose the Iranian hardliners, the Revolutionary Corps, they take over the country and they say, you know, these guys have been too moderate. We're abolishing the agreement. Then they have a problem with the international community. I don't think this is going to happen. But they also have a problem with the Iranian people, because what will happen is the sanctions will get lifted, things will start getting better, and suddenly you violate the agreement. I mean, it's asking for an explosion.
And they have to have a concern that, we'll stick up with the agreement or stick to the agreement, too. I just like to address a couple of things, the alternatives. First of all, you know, the GOP says, you know, McCain and the other warmongers, in my view, say that this is a bad deal. Well, it is the only deal. There is no better deal. It was negotiated by the world, and we can't arbitrarily make a better deal, number one. Number two is that the alternatives are maintaining, if Congress won't sign off on the deal, we would, you know, the alternative is maintaining the current level of sanctions, which there have already been indications that China and Russia and some others in Europe may not want to continue the sanctions, especially since they've already signed off on the deal. The second alternative is to increase sanctions, as Netanyahu and the conservatives want to do. So if we were to somehow increase the sanctions, it's quite clear that Russia and China and others wouldn't agree to it because their economies are hurting, too, and they want to do trade with Iran.
What the Obama administration did that was really good was to get all these other countries involved in it and signing off on it. And I think you're absolutely right. If it looks really bad, China and Russia will bolt. Once major countries bolt from the sanctions, then they stop working as much. As for the Republican opposition to us, we have, I have a quote, Gary, from Angus King, who's the independent senator from Maine. And he says to the Republicans, if these people who announced an hour and a half after the deal was announced were in a jury pool, they'd be disqualified.
Right.
Was your point earlier.
And I'd like to, you know, the last alternative to the deal and the worst alternative to the deal, it's what Netanyahu wants us to do, apparently, is to do a series of military attacks on Iran. Well, first of all, this is the nuclear. It's not like we would be attacking one plant. The nuclear industry is widespread throughout Iran. There are many installations and mines. And so it would be kind of a full-scale attack on Iran. The result of that is going to turn the Iranian people against us almost permanently, at least for the foreseeable future. And it would cause Iran to attempt to rebuild their program as quickly as possible, because there's no history of people attacking countries with nuclear weapons. So it's of the four alternatives, the deal is the only one that actually can work.
And I think it's an extremely good deal that no one really expected. For Republicans, I really, there are the wise men of the Republican Party in existence anymore. For them, it's a win-win situation. They oppose the deal. They cultivate their conservative right-wing base. The deal's going to go through. They know that. So they can go yell and scream, and yet the deal gets done anyway. So it's a win-win, but I must say the corruption of the Republican Party intellectually and politically does never cease to astonish me. They should be on this deal. They got almost everything that the U.S. wanted, and they got more than they thought they would get, and they still don't like it. Gary.
We'd be remiss if we didn't mention that who our sponsors are. It's Democrats of the Red Rocks, and I just want to say mention their upcoming events. They have a breakfast Thursday, September 17th is the next meeting, that's at the old Sedona Family Bar and Grill at 8 a.m. And then the annual picnic is coming up on Sunday, October 11th at Living Springs Campground in Oak Creek Canyon.
This show and all our other shows are available on the podcast at vvid.org, folks. vvid.org, the last three years of shows. We'll be right back.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.